You're listening to Understanding Revelation, an FFC equipping podcast course. In this two-part course, Pastors Todd Stiles, Mike Hartwig, and Travis Walker will take a theological deep dive into the various ways the book of Revelation is read and the multitude of views that stem from that, hoping to bring insight and clarity into what often seems to be the most cryptic book of the Bible. Session 1, Four Ways to Read Revelation.
You guys excited about talking about eschatology and Revelation?
Of all the topics of the Bible and all the theologies, this is probably the most intimidating.
I agree.
There's so much behind it.
The topic everybody loves to lean in on and has opinions on.
So. Yeah, why is that? The one we know the least about, we love to talk about the most.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's pretty heavy admonitions to do it carefully, that you don't add anything to it or take anything away from it.
Maybe it's because we're excited about the future.
Yeah, that's true.
We're ready for what's next.
Amen. Well, let me give you kind of a guide for how this is going to roll out. And this will help our listeners, our digital students, maybe do something on some paper they have with them or even digitally in their iPad or notepad. If you can, think about a four-column table. And we're going to use that in the first session to kind of walk through the lenses by which one can read Revelation. And so we maintain that you end up with a view about the end times, which that's what eschatology is. We might want to establish that first. Mm-hmm. Eschatology is the study of end times. You could use the phrase last things.
So let's back up and say, what type of lens are we looking at?
So we're talking filters.
You're talking about predispositions on the way we're looking at Scripture.
Sure.
The approach that we're taking to
presuppositions,
right.
Assumptions.
Okay. Right. Bias.
Things that we actually hold to and agree, believe.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And we all have them.
Right.
And I think we just want to recognize there are about four that are predominant lenses or filters or views by which you read Revelation. So what I was saying earlier was, when it comes to eschatology, I maintain that you typically will hold a view based on the lens you use to read Revelation. And I think sometimes we don't say that enough. We argue the views when we should back the truck up a bit and maybe give a little more graciousness, because if you read it a certain way, you'll know why they ended up there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah, but there also, that lens is developed in process. In other words, I come with presuppositions coming to these passages, and it's because of my background, the way I was raised, you know, that kind of thing. And so that lens now is part of me. So I'm going to naturally do that. But it's kind of like, for someone that has a completely open mind about everything, it's hard to say, well, you're reading it with a lens. Well, I don't have any lens.
Well, that person doesn't exist, I don't think.
Okay.
We all have paradigms.
Okay, right.
That we get when we're, you know, grown up, how we're raised,
okay,
experiences. And that's not wrong.
Right.
It's life.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. I think in this specific study, I mean, Travis is an example. You do grow up, and so you receive a lens, and you do accept it by faith, in the sense of, like, you just believe your parents, you believe the church you're in. And when you start to question it, you can sometimes feel guilty.
And I think this is helpful, because sometimes you grow up thinking there's only one lens, or you assume, or maybe are taught, that every other lens is wrong. And so I think this is helpful to just say there are different lenses. Let's talk about the pros and cons of them. So I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm. And I want to make this clear, that the lens that we're talking about is, how was the actual book written?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk that. That's a little bit of a hermeneutical approach.
Big word.
Yeah. It just means, how do we read the Bible? Mm-hmm. How do we preach the Bible? How do we study it? So I think that's an important concept, because you can't pretend the Bible wasn't written in a specific genre or in a specific manner in various books. We have to admit, even no matter what our lens is, this is a fact. So let's talk about that. So again, the four-column table. And so we're going to list for you the lenses that exist. I'll mention them, first of all, as a group. Okay, here's the four columns. There's a historical lens. There's the sequential lens. There's the thematic lens. And then there's the eclectic lens, which is the newest lens. These are all lenses, or we can call them filters or paradigms or presuppositions about Revelation, the book, the final book in the New Testament. And so if we read it a certain way, then we'll end up with a certain view. So let's talk first about column number one. You can read Revelation and, of course, the things that pertain to it. Let's say Christ's words in the Gospels when he talked about end times, the destruction of the temple, his coming. Those are all things in the Gospels. But Revelation speaks of them, so you could read it historically. That's column number one. Mm-hmm. Now, let me give a few facts about the historical column or the historical lens, or you could call it the historical approach. And then I'll have you guys comment a little bit. This is typically where preterists, or you could even say partial preterist, fall. And I want to be clear, there's a spectrum here that's pretty large, especially in the preterist camp. A full preterist would say even that Christ's coming has already occurred.
So what do you mean by preterist?
So everything's happened in the past. It's historical. So Revelation has been fulfilled.
Okay.
The spectrum is that there are partial preterists, and they would say most of Revelation is about things that have already happened, but they would say the coming of Christ is still to come.
Even less than most? Or is there some that would land in that category? A little?
I guess so.
Okay.
They're probably, I mean, that spectrum probably is full to partial to a little. For those who are wondering, like, well, when did Christ come? If you're a full preterist, when did they say he came? And they would say 70 AD. And the destruction of the temple was the coming of Christ. And so I'm not an expert at all on full preterism. I have a lot of appreciation for partial preterism. I'm curious, do you guys have any experience or knowledge about preterism anywhere on the spectrum?
Yeah, I'm sure you'll talk about this too, but I think just the continual learnings that I have is Revelation seems to be broken up into chunks. And so the first seven chapters primarily of Revelation seem to, it's easy or possible to point to historical events that show its fulfillment. And so continuing to learn that.
Yeah, it's a, no doubt a spectrum for us, isn't it, of where we're seeing this. Mike?
Yeah, it's the same thing as seven churches. It represents seven churches age. That's where this that they would fall in that category.
They would not fall in that category. They would not say those seven churches represent the ages. They would say they all occurred in the past.
Right.
Right. That would be the preterist view.
Right.
Yeah, they were literal churches.
Yeah. It makes me feel uncomfortable. It just doesn't make any sense. It seems like they're reading too much into the scriptures and things like that. So, but just to be clear, a preterist would say that this is you would read it from a historical perspective. This is all the stuff that has happened in the past, or partially. Some of it is happening, and then it's going to move on in the future.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And they would go to Matthew 24 and 25. Mm-hmm. They can go to Mark, I think it's 12 and 13, primarily 13. And they would show, and this is the part I appreciate, they would show how those things actually occurred in history.
Yep.
And they would then go to Revelation and say, this is what John was recounting.
And 70 AD is a big moment for the partial preterist viewpoint. We just wouldn't, those that fall into that camp wouldn't say that Christ returned at that date. Like, there was a lot of things that were fulfilled in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed, but maybe not that.
Yes, and there are some who would say, well, it wasn't as important as even Travis just said.
Right. Absolutely.
They would say, well, not as much happened as you think. So that's what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah.
This camp is, the historical camp is a large spectrum, probably more so than any of the other lenses. There's a wide swath of preterist, historicist is another word to use for them. I think one of the things that's interesting about the historical lens is they typically see Revelation 1 through 19 as past and 20 to 22 as still to come. And I'm not sure how, if you're a full preterist, I'm not even sure if I can explain how they arrive at Revelation 20 as still to come, unless they assume that the coming of Christ in 70 AD ends in 19 and 20 through 22 is describing what will one day unfold on the earth. I don't know exactly. So, to all of our digital students, you got three guys here who aren't preterist experts.
Great.
But I want to repeat, I do find a lot of appreciation for the partial preterist view because I see a lot of fulfillment in Matthew 24 and 25 and Mark 13. I see more fulfillment than I do less fulfillment. So I probably have some partial preterist tendencies personally. The thing about the full preterist that I have maintained, and I could be wrong about this. I don't think I am. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. I've been hoping someone who's a full preterist would talk to me about it. Maybe they hear this and they will. But I think full preterism is either close to or is heresy. If you deny the second coming of Christ, that he came, it seems like that would be heretical to me. So I've said I think full preterism is heresy. It's false teaching. But I don't know if that's – no one's challenged me on it. I don't know if it's accurate. What do you guys think about that statement?
I've never met a full preterist. I know it's a viewpoint, but I'm not – yeah, I have no name to put with that viewpoint. So
yeah, I have no comment on that other than I think they're reading too much into it. So okay. Yeah.
So I'm just thinking through that. But yeah, if a full preterist denies that Christ is coming again, he might say, no, he already came.
Yeah, right.
I'm not sure how I would have that conversation.
Right.
But just be aware, this first lens is the historical lens. Regarding this historical lens, it does seem to be fading in popularity, at least the full preterism part. From what I'm reading and gathering, there's not a lot of people who continually say, well, none of this is yet to be fulfilled. It's all already happened. So while I do think there's some partial preterism that's gaining some momentum, it seems like a lot of historical lens doesn't have a huge following as far as the full measure of it. So just kind of keep that in mind. Here's another thing that I think is interesting. Like, how does a historicist read Revelation specifically? Well, they would see the seven churches as ages that have passed. So, Mike, you made a point here about the seven churches. Some of them may see all the events as occurring in the past. So in that sense, they would be ages. I don't think they see them as current ages. They wouldn't say that we're in a certain Laodicean age right now.
Here's the problem I have with some of that is it looks like it's a problem looking for a solution in that here, the way I've always thought about this, how is the early church reading this? You know, how do they look at that? And you see a church in Laodicea, they're not thinking that, oh, this is, you know, the Roman Empire or something like that. It's not, and I can't overcome that. I can't say, well, when people start reading into it, it's sort of like what Ryrie did in Genesis, where he was talking about the ruin and restored thing about creation. It was like, yeah, but that's not, I have trouble imagining that that's what the early reader picked up, you know? And so you have to go back to kind of inject yourself into the mind of the early readers of this and say, is that really what they thought? Or when you look at what the Good Samaritan, where is really the Good Samaritan the Catholic Church? You know, they're reading that into that passage. And so they come up with a theology that's based on that. So, yeah, it's interesting. But I think it's extremely dangerous when you start reading things and you start seeing things that is not explicitly in that passage.
And what we should ask is maybe not necessarily what the reader thought, but what did the author intend?
Right.
I think that's even a greater question.
Yeah, but the author had intent? Yeah, what was he trying to communicate to the reader?
To the reader, and
right.
Did they
right. So
clearly
you can't,
know that?
Yeah, but you can't avoid, you can't separate. You have to say, you have to look at them together and put them, and to me, it's like you see that people reading into, well, God told me to do this, or I open my Bible because I'm struggling with a decision, so I point to this passage. I mean, let the passage say what the passage is saying, and then you add in there a good hermeneutic would say, or Bible interpretation would be, let this passage say what it's saying and don't read anything into it. But that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying this church in Revelation 1 represents this church in the church age. Well, does it really?
Or a church in the past.
Right, in the past, right.
Right.
And dispensationalists are known for that, you know, they're, and I consider myself a dispensationalist too, but that is probably one of the weak points of that is when you say, okay, well, this dispensation changes here and this really, is that really what the scriptures are trying to get us to think about?
Do you think a dispensationalist can be a historicist at the same time?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Because most of the historicists I know, they're not dispensationalists.
Right. Right. But all I know, what I mean by that is that dispensationalists like to look in categories. They draw lines. And so this is a pivot point in the way God changed and worked with people. And that's, in many ways, that's what they're doing with the seven churches.
Yeah, they do see like the seven churches as previous examples or ages.
Right.
They see the seals in 4 through 7 as the fall of Rome.
Right.
They see the beast and false prophet in chapters 12 and 13 as Catholicism and the papacy.
Right.
So how did an author then think about those things in the future. But to their point, and Travis, you might want to speak into this, they would say, well, that's the point of prophecy. You're predicting things that no one knows yet. Like, it's still to come. Mm-hmm. But, and then it happened.
Yeah. But predictions are dangerous, are highly faulty, right? Like, you're reading the culture and making evaluations, and it's a guess.
But it isn't that precise. I think a good prophecy, if it was really prophecy, it would say, this is going to happen, you know, and instead of speaking in a veiled tone, it's almost like, you know, you're adding things to it. And you add at the end of Revelation, it's almost like the Holy Spirit knew that some of this was going to happen. So he added this, hey, don't add anything else to the scripture. Don't add anybody who takes or adds to this. They're going to have a curse basically on their life of the things that are mentioned in Revelation. So I don't know. I find it great mental theater, but I think it's also very dangerous. And when you start living in that realm, I think that the biggest problem is that, it takes away from your presence and having a Christ-like presence because you're so caught up in, you know, what is in the moment.
A lot of historicists want to read their current generation into every text.
Yeah, right.
So the next generation,
right.
The next century, if those things didn't come true, then they're reading backwards saying, okay, well, what's it mean now? And that's a little bit of a hurdle for sure.
Yeah.
We're always warned against the danger of having your Bible open and your newspaper right next to it and
exactly
trying to find
right.
the straight lines.
It was Russia for many years, remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so just be aware that if you try to read current events into Revelation, trying to place all that into history, the next generation is going to do the same thing, and you might be the guy on the outs then. Mm-hmm. So this is the historical approach. It's a wide spectrum from full preterist all the way to partial, even less preterist. They have a historical lens that a lot of it's already happened. Let's go to column two, can we? This is the sequential lens. We call it a chronological lens. Typically, these folks are your futurists. You could call them your literalists. To use a word that Mike used already once, this is where most dispensationalists fall. They see it sequentially. Now remember, historical people who read it that way, they see it as fulfilled. These folks see it more like chronological, like there's still some things to come, and we've got to make sense of most revelation in the future. So they would say from chapters 3 on, for sure chapter 4 on, it's all still to come. Whereas the historicist says 19 and previous has already happened. Now I need you to picture in your mind, this is to our listeners here, picture in your mind things that are subsumed into another. And this is how they, in the sequential category, this is how they see the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. So they would see them as six happen, like six seals happen, and then the seventh seal happens, then the next seven things begin. And when that seventh thing happens, then the next thing. So they would say there are 21 things that happen. They're kind of subsuming to each other, and they're sequential. They happen in order. And so we've had a chart showing this in our class. We won't do that here on this course. But that's kind of how they see it. So they do see all these things happening in a row. Now, you're thinking probably now the book Left Behind or books like that. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the sequentialist or chronological lens. One illustration is to think about fireworks. Like you see one go off and then suddenly it explodes and then more go off from that one. That's a pretty good illustration of how they see Revelation. Most of these folks would see the rapture of the church as occurring when John says, I think it's chapter 4, maybe chapter 3, that he saw a vision in heaven and there was a door open. So they consider that the beginning of all the things that are about to occur. Mm. And so from 3 or 4 on to the end of the book, it's all future. And then prior to 3, which is the seven churches essentially, that's all, you know, what we can learn from now. Mm-hmm. So that's the sequential view. This is probably the view most of you have heard about or maybe been raised in or maybe accepted. True or false?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a position I would take on it. But on the other hand, I know there's plenty of gaps in it. So Travis, jump in here.
Dispensationalists are known for their charts.
Yeah.
I remember memorizing my end times chart, and it was very sequential. This, then this, then this, then this. Dispensationalists are very organized.
So the reason that is because of the word then.
Mm-hmm.
John says several times, then I saw.
Yep.
So they make a strong case that that word proves a sequential lens is the right lens. Yep. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think not on the then thing, but I think it's on the literalist because it plays naturally into our perspective on the Bible that's inerrant, you know, that to be taken literal. And then, but even at that, and I want to be careful, I say this cautiously because there are times when you can't literally say it's not literal. Like in Psalms, it says the sun rises the sun doesn't rise, the earth rotates, you know. So can we take that literally that the sun rises? Well, no. And so there are things like that where we have to be careful about that. And it's a point that I would make to say that there are things that we don't know and it's not clear in all understanding, but it's almost like we have all these concepts, the seals, the bowls, mm-hmm. The future coming of Jesus Christ or the past coming of Jesus Christ. And we have all these concepts and we lay them out on the table. Well, then it's a matter of how do we put it all together? And so the system that seems to work the best for me is that it is sequential, that as you point out, is then and then this.
I think it goes to interpretation style too. Like,
yeah.
You mentioned the word like literal, like does then mean then? John is retelling a vision. He's telling a story. And so he's wording his vision in such a way. And so then we as readers have to read his story with interpretive eyes. So does then mean literally then? Is it denoting a sequence or is it describing a scenario? I think that's something we've got to discuss.
I think the word then is a word that shows sequence in John's vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if it shows sequence of prophetic events. Right. And we can disagree here with those who mm-hmm. are sequentialist. Maybe I should say I, because I don't know where you guys land on this, but I don't see the word then as mandating that these events happen. I think the word is used when John says, then I saw that. So it's a sequence word for sure, but about John's vision, like kind of Travis said, not necessarily mandating that all these things have to happen in a row. So that's just a helpful tip that has helped me a lot understand, because I don't think, Revelation is not a narrative book. Typically, then is a word used in narrative. If you
how do you know it's not a narrative book?
Because it's an apocalyptic genre. Now there are some narrative passages, but the bulk of it's is a apocalyptic, almost poetic kind of language. A lot of it mirrors the Old Testament apocalyptic language. So yeah. I'm not saying apocalyptic can't be
right.
That's sequential.
Yeah, right.
It can.
Right.
But is John describing a sequence of events that we're going to live through, or is he describing a sequence of events in his vision?
But you would is your mind open to both, or is it you've landed? No, it can only be this.
I think the vision, no doubt, John is saying, I saw these things in this order. But do all those things he saw mean they have to happen in that order? Some would say yes. Some would say no.
Okay.
Yeah.
I tend to try to keep an open mind about that.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a new thought to me that it is order that is vision, but then it still doesn't negate or challenge the idea. It still could happen sequentially. He's quoting this or recounting events that happen sequentially, and he shows it sequentially too.
Yeah, sure.
So it's not either or. It could be a both and, or it could be just a recapturing of what happened over and over again, but it doesn't really solve the problem.
So here's some positives about the sequential view. I want to make sure I mention these. There is a lot of distinction in the sequential view, which is helpful. There's a lot of structure in that view, and there is a lot of flow. So those are positive things about the sequential view that make Bible study, it helps it to make sense.
Yep.
I think some of the negatives are that it is at times a little inconsistent. When is something literal and when is something symbolic or metaphorical? They do tend to make a, Mike, you mentioned this, they do tend to make a big deal about take it literally. until they don't want to take it literally.
Yeah.
Like they don't want to say there are seven spirits of God.
Yeah. Right.
But that's what Revelation says.
Right.
So they suddenly want to become, we love metaphors now.
Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be one of, I like the idea and I'm convinced that the Bible, we need to take it literal in those passages where it's clear that it's literally wrong to steal.
Right.
It's not metaphorically. That's not a metaphorical.
That's not, you're right. But here's an interesting point. A metaphor or a symbol is a literal device used in writing. So I don't think we should feel wrong, and Travis, you can speak into this, for looking at a genre and saying that's apocalyptic, it's poetic, and it's a, they're using a literal device to prove a point. Like we don't have to assume that like a dragon is a dragon. He may be trying to picture something of great power and devastation, perhaps. Does that make sense? That would be literal because he's using a device.
Well, it's literal to the mind of the reader or in the writer. Yeah, I like in Revelation, I heard people preach on that passage, oh, that dragon, look at this, they throw a picture on the screen of a helicopter.
And Apache helicopter. Yeah,
Apache helicopter was a like stinging dragon. In its tail. Okay. And they said, now you think about this, if you were in the first century church and you read that, and you saw that, how would you describe it? Well, they have no, they don't even have the word helicopter. So he is of the belief that in that passage, if we take it literally is a dragon. In our vernacular, it would be a helicopter.
Huh.
So.
Not sure what to say to that.
Yeah, right. But.
So that's obviously not literal.
Yeah. Well,
he's not taking it literal.
Yeah. I guess you're right. But in my mind, I'm thinking, yes, but. I mean, no, mm-hmm. but I guess in that case. Because it is a literal physical being with a thing that in their mind looked like a dragon. And so the only description they had was this dragon.
Yeah.
It was this helicopter, rather.
I grew up dispensational. And hearing that kind of argument is we read the Bible literally, and to Todd's point, until they didn't. And it seemed just super confusing and inconsistent for a young man who was trying to understand his Bible. So Jesus has a sword coming out of his mouth. Well, that's not literal. Jesus doesn't actually have a sword coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, right.
But most things are literal. Well, then right. I'm like, I'm super confused. Jesus have a tattoo on his thigh? No, we don't like tattoos. So no, he doesn't have a tattoo on his thigh. And I'm just as a young guy who was super impressionable, that was super inconsistent to me. And I struggled with it. And so then to understand that genres do play a big part in biblical interpretation was so helpful for me. So in Revelation 1:3, when he says the word prophecy, bless the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear the words of this prophecy. He doesn't say narrative. He doesn't say historical events. He says prophecy. That was super helpful to me. John's painting a picture. It's my job to interpret the picture or to do my best to understand the picture being painted.
Lean on this a bit. I think we talk about inconsistencies being one of the things that sequentialists have to wrestle with. You know, one of the big things is you've got to make sure that you become a Christian before the rapture. They would see the rapture there in chapter 3, I think, or 4, mm-hmm. something like that. But yet they would maintain that there are people who get saved later.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would say, well, not just anybody, but only if you've never heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember early in college and even later hearing that and then thinking, but Romans 1 seems to say that
without
we're
excuse.
All condemned to period just by creation. Like mm-hmm. there's no excuse.
That's right.
So how... Does that make sense? Like, yeah. It seems like there's a lot, some workarounds if you take a sequentialist view completely.
That's the challenge with how organized the dispensational view is. There's always buts. Nothing is perfectly clean. There's always exceptions to even your own rules.
In all the views.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true.
Yeah,
you're right.
Absolutely.
You're right.
So yep.
But just because you don't see, they make allowances for that. They create a scenario where, you know, Satan is banished for 1,000 years. And during that time, people are able to procreate. And then Satan is released right before or after the millennium. And then that's when another rebirth happens in people's lives. So I think just because that's a but. It's, statement. In other words, yeah, okay, so here's where we would put that. And that goes back to, we got all these issues on the table. How do we make everything fit? I mean, Ryrie's did that, and yeah, and so he recognized there's a gap there. Well, we got to have people come to know Christ again. or get saved again. And so they, that's, where do we put that? So they have their nice chart and say, well, let's put it here, you know, and kind of, that has always made me feel, as a dispensationalist and a pre-trib guy, and a, it has always made me feel uncomfortable. How do we put all that together?
You feel almost forced to find a way to make your system work.
Right.
And you're right. Every one of these lenses has some gymnastics.
Right.
So that's just one of them here. And at times, it, in my opinion, the sequentialist can sometimes seem a little bit repetitive or even confusing. Like, well, how many judgments are there?
Right.
How many resurrections are there?
Right.
How many gatherings are there? You say there's a rapture, then you say there's a second coming. Is that one or is that two? And, and explaining all that can sometimes be difficult. So that's just one of the negatives. There's many positives, just like the historicist view has that. Again, the sequentialist would be the futurist, what we'd call the chronologicalist, so to speak. So we've got three columns under our belt. At least we've tried to tamper with them a little bit and dive into them. The historical column, which would be the spectrum of the preterist or the historicist. Then there's the sequential column. That's one lens to use. And this would be those who are futurist or literalists. And then we have the third column, which would be the thematic lens. You could call this an idealist lens or even the symbolic lens. They would be probably most known because of how they read Revelation as they read it through a recapitulationist lens. They see it as telling the same story multiple times. A sequentialist, in contrast, would see it telling one story all in a row. And so a thematic person, a person who sees it as a thematic lens, they would see not the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls as subsumed into each other, like fireworks coming, you know, one after the other. They see them as one judgment, but from different vantage points. Now, I would say this, most recapitulationist or thematic lens people, they do see an escalation in these judgments. They would say it's one judgment shown three different ways, but they do seem to have an escalation to where it intensifies. So they would say it's like the movie Vantage Point. Remember the movie Vantage Point, and you had the same scene, I think it was seven or eight times, but they showed it from different camera angles. That's what they're saying Revelation is. And especially with the seals, trumpets, and bowls, they're just saying this is the judgment of God from this angle or from that angle or from this angle. And so it's like various camera angles, instant replays, so to speak. Again, we had a chart kind of showing this in our live class. We don't have that here in this point. But this is one way to read Revelation, is through a recapitulationist viewpoint. I would remind you, there is an interesting aspect about this is that they typically have Revelation divided into seven parts. And I don't have that list in front of me, but the seven parts, they would say that's significant that the number seven is used. And so they have a number of ways to show that it's poetic, apocalyptic, and that it has very much a symbolic significance in the retelling of the story. Here's some positives to this, and you guys can lean in here. One of the positives is there's a lot of similarity in things like events, patterns, and phrasing, which leans in like John's trying to tell one story. There's a lot of consistency within Revelation if you hold this view, and it's very consistent in the fact that much of the language in Revelation is used in some of the Old Testament books. And so that's a consistency, and that's a positive in that it's consistency. Some of the negatives would be that at times this view can be dismissive of certain words, like the word then. I think that's a real core thing to this view, is that what do you do with the word then? This continually moving, escalator events. And that's something you got to be able to answer. And then the other one, Mike, is I think you've already addressed it without even knowing it, is there does seem to be almost the other side of the coin, is everything's allegorical.
Yeah.
Like you can make it mean whatever you want, just, you know, and they've got to be able to answer that.
Right.
Some say that's bad practice. Maybe it's bad practice too if you don't do it well. But I think those are some negatives. It can be a little a tad dismissive and very allegorical. So speak into that, guys, can you, about some of those positives and negatives, or even this view called the recapitulationist view?
I've always considered them people that just kind of rehash and they say it from different. I've always thought, well, they haven't really it just doesn't carry any weight with me. It's just like the way the language is and the consistent use of then, is it really that we're just rehashing the same story over and over from different, and the main thing is that there's different scenarios and different things, even though, you know, that movie, if I remember correctly, they had the same language that was going through as they looked at it from different vantage points. And while you have some similarities in the language, well, the narrative of the Antichrist and the beast and all that, that's different with the different bulls. And they're different things with the bulls and the seals. There's enough difference there to say you can't say that this is just the same scene being played from different vantage points. So that's because there's too much different language.
Yeah, that's one of their strengths is they have a lot of distinction. Sequentialists have a lot of distinction. Yeah. That is a positive. You're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is a little more of a similarity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Travis, lean in there a little bit.
I think it's good to remember how this letter would have been read. It would have been read as a, you know, in one sitting or all together. And so you would have gotten these as the listener or the reader, you would have come together with these kind of mental pictures in your head. I think sometimes the sequential view chops it up so much. It's kind of like they're looking at the trees instead of the forest. I think the thematic view does a better job, in my opinion, of seeing the forest and saying, like, look at the landscape that's been painted. Look at common themes. I was just kind of looking through it a little bit. And even in Revelation chapter 7, the word then in the CSB is kind of translated after this, or like, and then he uses the phrase like, I saw. And so the story is being told, you know, John is sharing us with the story of what he saw. I don't think it's fair to take that out and just say like, then this happened. A lot of times John's just telling you the story of what he saw.
Yeah. The word then and the phrase after these things or after this, they're all connected to his vision.
His vision.
Yeah.
He's not giving you a chronological, in my opinion, chronological listing.
And to Mike's point, he's saying that vision could relay the actual order of the events. Some say, no, it's describing the same event from different angles. So this is the thematic approach. One thing that I think is interesting that I want us to comment on is the thematic approach helps me understand some of the chapters in Revelation that at times seem like they're misplaced. And I'll use that word respectfully. Like you're reading this sequence of events, and then suddenly you come to, I think it's chapter 11, 12, or 13 in there, where he tells the entire story of creation, like a woman gave birth, fought against this enemy. And so when I used to read it and think, now how does this work in a sequential view? Like, does everything stop or is this? And it began to be, it appeared to me like a retelling of everything. So I think this view lends itself to understanding Revelation better when you think about those ones that are like suddenly just inserted. Like, why are they suddenly here in this sequence? That's just an opinion. It helped me a lot.
Have you guys ever preached through Revelation, like chapter by chapter?
No.
It's tough.
Yeah.
Because of
exactly. That's probably why I said no.
Exactly. I've not preached in church, but I've, you know, taught it in like Sunday school classes or to teenagers and things like that. And you bump into those things when you go chapter by chapter. So there's so much context you have to share when you're like, okay, we're in Revelation 8. Let me summarize and it's hard. Yeah. Rather than like First Kings, you just kind of plow right through and the characters are easily developed. It's so challenging.
So you probably lean towards a sequentialist view, or at least you right. appreciate that and things about it. Like, how have they answered that about these insertions that seem to be a sudden break in the sequence? Do you know? I mean,
it's one of the problems that you have when you have that position, but it's like, yeah, okay, let's take a pause. Let's reflect. And it's more of a recapturing of setting up the narrative of what's coming up next. I guess that's what I would probably say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we do that in teaching all the time. I mean, before I get going on this, let's reflect on what's going on over here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is the thematic view. A word you can use here is idealist. So if you were to put like a noun to each of these columns about people like who are in these groups, you would say that the first group is historicist. And within historicist, you're going to have the full spectrum of preterism. In the second column, they're known as futurists. And the third column is going to be the idealist. And so those are words you may read or hear as you think about lenses for Revelation. Let me mention one more. It's the fourth column. This is the newest. And by the way, speaking of a view's place in history, the sequential view is the newest or most recent view apart from the one I'll mention in a minute. In other words, it came about probably more from Darby. That's going to be a couple of centuries ago or so. And they proposed it and made it famous. Of course, I think Ryrie and some of those folks,
right.
A lot of dispensationalism came out of the sequential view. The thematic approach is probably the oldest view, to go to the other extreme. That'd be those from church fathers, Augustine, Ignatius. I think those are the ones who would hold a more of a metaphorical view, just to give some context to how long a view's been held or how new it is. I know we think 1800, 700 is old, but really it's not. So just keep that in mind. This next view, called the eclectic view, or the eclectic lens, is even newer than the sequential view. But here's what it does, and I think it may be an effort by many people to try to find the best in all the approaches. This is an actual view. I've Googled it and looked at it, and you can as well. But it is kind of the desire of many to find the positive points in all of the different views and then combine them to try to fill in some of the gaps. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so the actual name is the eclectic approach. Here's the word I like to use for these people. I like to call them synthesists. So they try to synthesize a lot of the things into an approach that maybe reduces the gaps or reduces the gymnastics. So here's what one definition says, that the eclectic approach interprets the book of Revelation in a way that aims to incorporate the strengths of each of the other main approaches. The eclectic approach acknowledges there are elements of truth in all of the approaches identified thus far. So they would say each lens has a positive. Let's take those positives and let's find the good in it and let's put all those into one view. Make sense?
Mm.
So we call them synthesis. I don't have a whole lot more about this view because it is so new, and I've only read about it in books where it's been like one chapter. I've not even seen a whole book about it yet. That's how new it is. So, you know, we used fireworks as the example for sequential. We used the movie Vantage Point for an example of thematic. I think maybe an example of this would be a casserole. just throw everything in there and put it in the oven and see what happens. Hmm. So any comments on this eclectic approach? How new is it to you? Have you heard of it before?
No. Never heard. Yeah. Never mm-hmm. engaged it.
Nope. I just heard about it actually before I taught the class live.
Sure.
And I thought maybe someone was using it as an illustration, but it actually is an approach. I would say this is kind of my heartbeat when I say to our church, and we say to our church a lot of times, that above everything, we're pro-coming. Mm. Like we may have differences, even our elder team, about some of these minor issues, but every elder, every one of our leadership is pro-coming. So we're kind of taking the strengths and pointing in the certain direction so we can find good unity. Mm. So I love the heartbeat of this eclectic approach. I don't know much about it though.
There are some things that, even though on the eclectic, I think it's important we remember there are some things that are non-negotiable. There's a lot of room for negotiation in here. But there are a few things that we have to, if we're going to follow Jesus Christ, I think it's really clear in all the positions under care, and the positions need to fall in line with those do's and don'ts. You know, like number one, we need to understand that how is the original reader reading this? Like, what is in their mind when they go through and when they were reading it? And that there's a lot of room for interpretation on that, even. It's like, so.
Yeah, that's actually the first item in our do's and don'ts. So let's just mention these four things and we'll move on to, we'll close out this session.
Okay.
Do remember the original audience. And if you're listening in on this course, just maybe jot these four things down. But do remember the original audience. Mike, you were speaking to that even earlier about how important that is. Second thing would be to do realize that symbols are literal devices for literature. And so I kind of constructed the sentence that way on purpose because I want to try to find some unity between literalist and symbolist. Like, symbols are literal devices. We shouldn't discount them. So you can be literal when you're using a metaphor. That's what I'm saying. Whether you agree, Mike, I don't know.
But. I want to agree with you, but I don't want to agree with you because I think there's safety in that. And I think there's plenty of people when they're dealing with their own personal sin that they look for and they'll use that as an excuse. Well, that's not literally what it means. It's like I can't have an affair with my wife. That really, on my wife. It's like, wait a minute. That's not literally what it says.
It's what it plainly says.
Right.
So I would say I believe in the plain meaning of Scripture,
right.
The literal sense. I'm more hold to that like you are.
Yeah.
But metaphors and symbols are actual devices. They're not wrong to use to describe things. That's all I'm saying. And so Revelation does have some of
those. And I agree with that. But, you know, I had a really nice, lively discussion with a priest one time, and he was talking about the Good Samaritan and how every character in this Good Samaritan was a symbol.
Mm.
And it eventually came back to the Catholic Church, of course. But I walked away from that conversation, and it was ingrained within me that not everything in the Bible is a symbol. And so I'm falling out of the canoe one side saying, I want to be a literalist.
Yeah. Not everything walks on all fours.
Yeah. Right.
And Travis, we were at that workshop on parables. And that's one thing people do in the parables is they try to make every element mean something and it doesn't.
Right.
Is to drive home one truth.
Right.
Yeah. Third thing would be this. Do use the Old Testament and Jesus' words to understand John's use of apocalyptic language. So there are some quotations and there are things that harken back to things Jesus said and even to what Old Testament writers said. So do remember that. It's not a book that stands alone in that sense. And then fourthly, be more pro-coming than any pre- or post-position. Perhaps that's what you were saying, Mike, about non-negotiables, you know?
Yeah.
That we want to make this, what did he say in Acts 1? Like, this same Jesus will come in the same way. Yeah. So we would hold here, and Travis, you can comment on this. You lead our membership class, the visible bodily return of Jesus Christ. That's one of our confessions.
It's our core belief right there.
Yeah.
Our end times view.
So I think that automatically eliminates us, at least, from being a full preterist.
Right.
We would say there's Acts 1 still to come.
Yep.
Here's four don'ts. Just jot these down. Don't misdefine the term last days. Have you heard this before? Like, hey, are we in the last days yet? People ask you that question ever.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, I think Peter said in Acts 2 that Joel was being fulfilled and in these last days. So Peter declared the last days began at Pentecost. So we are in the last days. We've been in them since Pentecost. So I think it's a hype move to ask the question and wonder, when has it started? Mm-hmm. Are we in these certain days now where things are going to get worse? I always say we've been in them since Pentecost.
Right.
We're in the last days, so quit worrying.
Right.
It's not something to figure out. We just read the Bible.
Yeah. And so by making that statement, you're saying that people are saying, well, the last days is yet to come.
Yeah. They try to create a scenario in which it can, you know, it can build your fear, I think.
Right.
And I think that's not helpful.
Right.
The last days have been defined in the Bible.
Right.
We're in them. But so was the Apostle Paul.
Right. Mm.
So that kind of, suddenly it kind of smooths out, oh, we're not the first.
Yeah.
This has been going on for a while.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I would say don't force America, Russia, China, Henry Kissinger, Barack Obama, or Donald Trump, or other hot news and headlines into the text.
Okay? Oh, yeah. That's a great one. Yeah, head wound. A guy who recovers from a head wound. That's going to be the Antichrist, you know? So there it is.
And Travis said it, you know, reading the Bible in your newspaper, I don't know if it's a great idea either.
Remember that book back in the 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming Back in 1988? That was a big time book. And then the next year, 89 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming Back. He had a sequel.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It didn't sell as well that second year.
I imagine not. Travis, lean in a little bit here on this question, because someone could hear the idea of the newspaper and the Bible together, and they may think, well, I want the Bible to inform my current situations and my cultural views. I don't want to divorce the Bible from my real life. I don't think you do either, but yet you're right in that we don't want to try to read the paper into the Bible. Walk us through that balance.
Exactly what you said. You're not trying to find, you're not taking the newspaper, something you read in the newspaper and think, oh, it's got to be in the Bible. So we take a current war that's going on and think like, oh, there's got to be a chapter and verse because it's prophecy. There's got to be a chapter and verse that proves this is exactly what's happening. And I think that's where you're trying to force an agenda or a biasness into the text. Read the text, let that, you know, be our guide and what teaches us the will of God, the desire of God, and then go read your newspaper. And what it should create is when the world's falling apart, like the newspaper tells you, it gives you confidence that God's still in control. I think that's as
That's good.
As far as we should take it.
That's helpful. The third don't is this: don't make revelation about knowing times and seasons, but rather about knowing Jesus. And you know, the actual title of the book of Revelation, if I can use that phrase, it's the unveiling of Jesus. And sometimes in our current church culture, we miss that. We just hear revelation. We don't think about what the word is. It's actually apocalypse. It's the unveiling. So the book's not about times and seasons, which Jesus said to the disciples, don't worry about that. Remember? Mm-hmm. He said, you worry about being witnesses. I'm going to give you Holy Spirit. That's what your job is. So I think sometimes, and I've been guilty of this, we worry more about the times and seasons, trying to figure out things related to the when, as opposed to like, this book is unveiling Jesus for me. I want to know him better. So I want to encourage you, stay focused on the point of the book, which is Jesus. Any comments on that?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I think sometimes we get caught up in the nuance. When the Left Behind series came up, it was a rave. And so everybody in the church said, hey, let's do a series on end times, you know, and all that. So a lot of people were doing it. And one of the things that I've discovered, there's a whole bunch of people that kind of get caught up in the hype of it all. And while it is exciting to think about what's coming next and where we're going, it's almost like we forget the basics of blocking and tackling, the basics of living out of your faith in a day-to-day way. And we forget that this is just a book to explain Jesus Christ. And so my hope for the people that are listening to this is that you naturally read the book of Revelation, and there's a lot of chatter. It's like, you know, you have like 15 sounds going on off in your head. There's a lot of things that you can't. I just read this like last week, read through Revelation again, and I was overwhelmed with, oh man, how do I fit this? How do I fit this? What about this? What about this? I can see this here. And pretty soon your mind is just overwhelmed with it all. But then when you step back and you get to that last chapter, it is about Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's about what we do with him. And God hates sin. If nothing else, Revelation proves that Jesus Christ hates sin and that he will not tolerate it forever, and that there is an end times coming, and there is going to be a time when we will be with him forever. And if we can focus in on that and let the details lay where they are and focus on what God calls us to do on a day-to-day basis, I think that's where the real value of the book of Revelation is.
The last don't is this: don't break fellowship over eschatology, because you'll be worshiping with them eternally.
Yeah.
So I just want to encourage our listeners, even in our church here, there's some people who hold every one of these lenses.
Yeah.
We have sequentialists with us. We have historicists with us. We have thematic people, and we have some eclectics. And we get along well, and we're pro-coming. Like you said, we're going to focus on the main things, hopefully. We have some fun debates, for sure, but we don't break fellowship over eschatology.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good thing to keep in mind. And so these four do's and don'ts, again, they're all designed to apply to each of these columns. I'll review them briefly before we close this course, and then we'll go to session two, we're going to lay out the views that come from these. And we did not mention a single actual view, which is helpful. We just went through the lenses by which you read Revelation, because the lens you choose will be the determining factor for which view you hold. So these do's and don'ts, again, they apply to all of us, whether you are a historicist, a literalist or futurist, whether you're a recapitulationist, or we call an idealist, or whether you're a synthesist and hold to the eclectic view. These do's and don'ts apply. These are the lenses by which you will use the Revelation. Either you'll read it as a narrative in sequential fashion, you'll read it as apocalyptic and perhaps hold to a symbolic kind of idealist view. You may read it as history and hold to a already fulfilled view. But how you read Revelation will play a huge part in the view you hold. And that's on our next session, the four main views that come out of these lenses. We'll talk to you then.
Thanks for listening to the FFC Equipping Podcast. For more resources and podcasts to help you develop as a devoted follower of Christ, go to firstfamily.church/resources.